Jai Ma. So we continue with the mother's collected works, volume 10, which is her commentaries on thoughts and aphorisms. And as the mother has said that this is when she gets that impression that Shivabindu wrote these when he was as if piercing a hole through the supermind, from the intuitive mind to the supermind. So what is the main difference? One of the main differences is intuition also shows us the truth. But it shows us the truth of the moment in a particular space-time context. So supposing there is a person who walks in and somebody living in an intuitive mind will see through, can say roughly, you know, what is going on, what's happening there, what is inside, what are the possibilities, all this he can see. But the supermind will show us the entire past, present, future, his place, why things are happening, the totality. It will show it in all the various countless relations. So that's why yogis have gone to intuitive mind and had this capacity. But supermind completely changes the view because it's an all-comprehending truth. It's not a truth like typical how the mother explains the overmind gods. Each works according to his own principle, his own way of being or mode of being. And we see how it sometimes creates conflicts even between the gods, because that way of being is fine. It is a truth in its own right. But this truth does not take into account all the countless other truths that are taking place in this world. That's why the mother says that the world of formatios. So formatios are those who give form right from overmind downwards. And each of them gives a little angle. And that little angle is enough to completely change things. What we see today here appears as a distortion. So when we look at the distortion, it is such a contrast with the original that there is a tendency, unless one has gone into the supermind and sees the entire play, to regard this as untrue. It is false. They don't see it as a distortion. This is, how can this be? And the mother gives us one of the examples which was an eye-opener to me. You'll read it as we go through. She says, cruelty was something most repugnant to Sri Aurobindo. Most. It was like farthest from the divine. And yet even that is a mask. So what is it a mask of? Mother says that it's a mask of a certain intensity of love which changes into a distorted mask, of course. So the difference is that if it is a distortion, we can set it right. We know what is the origin. If it is not a distortion, but just some inexplicable, somehow this kind of ugliness, then you can't set it right. You have to either leave it or you have to fight within the means that are given to you. But it doesn't have a relation with anything to do with truth. So this is where we'll probably start. There are a series of aphorisms on this aspect and we'll read few of them. One of them is where Sri Aurobindo writes, I heard a fool discoursing utter folly and wondered what God meant by it. Then I considered and saw a distorted mask of truth and wisdom. So even in the most foolish things, even in a madman's utterances, there is something and the supermind catches it and pulls by that hook. That's why it is the hope of hopes. Otherwise we see only the surface distortions, we pass judgments, we label people and we forget that what there is something else inside. So often, at least, you know, seeing patients and all, I see that there is a great truth inside which is hiding, but it has taken this shape. So if you catch that, if you encourage that, if you know, it has a lot of practical implication. That's what we read last time about ugliness and beauty. And so the person asked that how can folly be a distorted mask of truth? It is the very definition of folly that Sri Aurobindo gives here. A mask is something that conceals, that makes invisible what it covers. And if the mask is distorted, it not only renders invisible what it conceals, but also totally changes its nature. So the person asks, does Sri Aurobindo mean that there is no absolute falsehood and no absolute untruth? And the mother's answer, there can be no absolute untruth. By its very nature, it's only truth which is absolute. We can maybe slow it because it will interfere. So there is no absolute untruth. Only truth is absolute. I mean, it's even logical if you see. How can there be eternal hell? There has to be eternal is only one reality. The eternal hell which gives the feeling as if it is eternal. Impression. So that's the distortion which takes place. It is an actual fact. It is not possible because the divine is behind all things. So this is where it's a great reminder to us. And it's not just a philosophical truth, as I said, it gives us the ultimate hope. If the divine is behind everything, then there is always hope. But if this world is cut off from divine, then there is actually no hope. Whatever you may try ultimately, at best so-called individual escape. So this is where Sri Aurobindo reminds us. And this goes on, there is another aphorism where he says, God is great, says the Mohammedan. Yes, he is so great that he can afford to be weak whenever that too is necessary. Because sometimes we say, why God is not helping, why things are. He seems to be as if powerless. And we see that even in real examples of history, that you know, he seems like Sri Krishna suddenly running away from the battlefield with a certain purpose. So, and then further, God often fails in his workings. It is the sign of his illimitable Godhead. So how can God fail in his working? Because we have this idea, he has to always succeed. And from this idea always comes this, that supposing I pray and it's not granted, that means mother has not granted this. And you know, she has said, I am on a wrong track. No, perhaps this failure, even repeated failure, is meant to prepare me for something much greater. That's how we see the Pandavas repeatedly failing in their endeavors. Actually, they never, in worldly sense, they never succeeded. Even after they won the war, they never really ruled the kingdom. So this is how, when we look at it, at one place, Sri Aurobindo says that the world has advanced through half a dozen revolutions, and most of them were failures in their own time. One of them is the French Revolution, where Sri Aurobindo was behind it. Mainly Napoleon was one of the instruments. His force was there behind Napoleon. And we see that, you know, that time he spoke about freedom, equality and fraternity. Today, the Indian Constitution starts with that. In the preamble, you'll see three words. I'm forgetting the sequence. Perhaps it is equality, fraternity and freedom. And it's so interesting that when that revolution failed, actually Napoleon died an incognito death. So there are many things like that where failure prepares. And so in life also we can take the same lesson. So he again says, she says, Sri Aurobindo does not say that God has any need of weakness. See, the words have to be picked up. So he says that in any particular hole, for the perfection of the play of forces, a moment of weakness may be just as necessary as a display of strength. This is to widen the outlook of certain moralists who attribute definite qualities to God and will not permit him to be otherwise. God has to be always successful. That's why they can't understand Rama. They can't understand Krishna. Because at one place, quite a few places it seems. I imagine that if he is God, people have asked questions. Why did he run after the deer just because she has asked? And if he ran away, why couldn't he do some magic or miracle that nothing happened to Sita? But when you look at the whole story, then you understand. So, this is what she is saying. And then she says, why this happens? Because there is a distortion in the Western attitude and the Christian idea of God. And the Christian idea of God is, she says, it is extremely difficult for the Western mind to understand in a living and concrete manner that everything is the divine. And she says that there is this Christian idea that God is up there, Islam also, that God is up there, and this is, there is no God here. But you have to live according to the laws that he has given through our prophet. So that's the logic, that God is there, but he has given, revealed or inspired one prophet for with his laws. And it is he who has given the law. Now mankind has to live according to the law. And then whatever else is blah, blah, blah. You have your own belief. But basically that's how the logic operates. But in Indian conception, God is not only above, he is above, transcendent, but he is also within. He is also in the universe. And therefore each individual can connect with him and become one with God. Because ultimately that is the truth. But it is not only the truth within, it is the truth of manifestation also. Repeatedly she says, in manifestation, what was God. What is God. And what is going to happen will be God. So people often wonder why. So she will explain all that step by step. But there is nothing other than God. Only he exists. There is nothing outside him. And if something, now you see that's where the explanation comes. And if something seems ugly to us, it is simply because he no longer wants it to exist. So this is a stage of evolution. I often see this example of gladiators, or if you go back to even our Mahabharata times, or you know, times of Ramayana war, or gladiators, you know, in a combat, let's say something like our Olympic or WWF, you know, you could kill. That's how it was, and the public decided. People who were watching decided whether he should live or be killed, and it was not considered a crime. You kill. Or suddenly you will see that a lion is unleashed, and it was all public display. So it was at that point of time, what was God doing? He was bringing out the highest human spirit in the face of the extreme danger, because that's how the world was going through. And when you read those stories, even there is a movie on this, what you appreciate is not this cruel display which is going on, but one person who suddenly revolts. And you see that, oh, that's a courage. Like recently people talk about this Palestine and this conflict. See, Hamas leader's son, suddenly he's turned against his own people and said, no, what they are doing is not right. What my dad is doing is not right. Now you see, that kind of courage comes out in the face of extreme adversity. But then as evolution proceeds and this becomes more and more generalized, then we don't need these methods. So what happens? Within us, a sense of repulsion comes. And in individual life, because it's a small scale, it's very easy to see this. In young age, people commit all kinds of, you know, if not excesses, then certain things which, you know, when you look back, you say, oh, I was so stupid. But that time, that stupidity was part of your growth. Then another time comes when you want to discard that stupidity. You suddenly realize, and then you put an effort, and then eventually it goes away. So that's how the whole evolution proceeds. So all is God. Even in the movement we see that there is God in the becoming. He no longer wants it to exist. He is preparing the world so that this thing may no longer be manifested. So that the manifestation can move from that state to something else. So naturally, within us, individually, and when the collectivity is ready, then collectively, we violently repulse everything that is about to go out of the active manifestation. There is a movement of rejection. And see, like people often say, why this happened, this crime, this, you know, that Bengal incidents and all these kind of things. This is how, unfortunately, the collective mind of humanity gets shaken. Otherwise, we may not do this kind of a gory crime, but an average human being is still indulging in fantasies of that kind, which is as sordid, and there you see it gets reflected in a it's like a symptom bursting out of a disease. So that's what the mother is reminding. We have to understand it as a passage. What each one has to do individually is a different thing. If you feel revolted and if you feel inside the urge that you should take a stand, take a stand. She is not saying that you don't take a stand, don't, just accept things. No, she is not saying that. She is saying understand. Whether you accept or take a stand is a later part. But you must understand what this play is about so that hate and repulsion passes away even when you take a stand. That's the whole thing. But it is him. There is nothing but him. This is what we should repeat to ourselves from morning to evening and from evening to morning. Because we forget it at each moment. There is only him. There is nothing but him. He alone exists. There is no existence without him. There is only him. That's why we have that image of Chinnamasta who has cut her own head. That's why we have the image of Gauri on the peaks becoming Kali or Dhumavati in the lowest. So at each level, the divine manifests himself very differently. And that's how the evolutionary gradations are created. There is that Bhairav temple in Ujjain. So there people offer alcohol to the deity. Now, it's okay. There is a level where people worship like that. But that doesn't mean that I should go and do it. That's a different thing altogether because each stage is different. That's why in Tantra you have three gradations of puja. So one, those who are more like an animal and rakshasik. So you have Pashupati, Shiva. See, Shiva is easily, the asuras get easily attracted to him. And he's quick to please. He knows these fellows, you know. And he's quick to please. And what do they worship? That magnificent power, which is what they want. But this power is under the control of Shiva. So he knows how to train them, discipline them through everything. And then finally when they are ready, that is when they turn to Krishna. Krishna's way is very different. Krishna will take you along, laughing along. But he is a hard taskmaster. Not at all easy to please because now you are entering into a... It's not that one is greater than the other. Both are one, but at different levels they are operating. So that's what the mother reminds us. Yes, yes, he is... He is totally in it. He himself is the play. We speak of God, but we should remember that there are all these gradations of consciousness. And when we speak of God and his play, we mean God in his transcendent state beyond all the levels of matter. And when we speak of the play, we speak of God in his material state. So he becomes this, like a film director, story writer has become all the characters. But in each one he is reflecting something. And then when you see the whole play in totality, then one understands. Then she speaks about the concept of sin. So there is an aphorism. Because sin, in Indian thought, sin was never occupied a place like that. Because... We always looked at things as crookedness. Things were not straight. They were deviant. They had deviated from truth. But this idea of sin by the moralist Christian notion. So Shobindu writes, sin is that which was once in its place. Persisting now, it is out of place. There is no other sinfulness. Now imagine, Buddha before the urge to save mankind, moved by the suffering. It would be sin in that sense that if he left his wife and said, I want to just go, conquer kingdoms, earn money, etc. But when the urge has awakened within him, which now is all encompassing, then for the same Buddha to continue indulging and leading that kind of life would become a sin. So it's a question of where you stand in your inner evolution. So the mother says that, commenting on this aphorism about sin, which is basically things out of place, but had a purpose in their own time. The concept of sin is something that I do not understand and have never understood. Mother is saying that. Original sin seems to me one of the most monstrous ideas that man could ever have. Sin and I don't go together. That's why somebody asked me about Garuda Purana. I said, you don't have to take everything as authentic and true. Anyways, Puranas are smritis. They are not Shrutis. They are not Vedas, Upanishad, Gita and certain Tantras. They are Shrutis. They are revealed scriptures. But if you take every Purana as true, then if you read Garuda Purana, you like sin and torture in hell and all kinds. If you read it, looks like somebody who wanted to, a very crude mankind, to remind them, look here, you will be punished very badly in hell. That's how it looks. If you read it, it's not justified by any mystic experience subsequently. None of the mystics speak that language. So we have to understand that many of these stories, like she says, in Christianity, there is the concept of original sin. So it's a monstrous idea. So naturally, I fully agree with Sri Aurobindo that there is no sin. This is understood. Certain things like cruelty could be called sin. But I can only see this explanation that it is a distortion of the taste or need for an extremely strong emotion, sensation. I have observed in cruel people that they feel ananda at that moment. They find an intense joy in it. And also she says this about cruelty. Cruelty was one of the things that was most repugnant to Sri Aurobindo. But he always said that it was the distortion of an intensity. One could almost say the distortion of an intensity of love. Something that was not, that is, which is not satisfied with the middle course, which wants extremes, and that's how it exists. So there is a consciousness which is so dark, you can't shake it, extreme tamas, apart from these violent sensations. That's how people love a lot of party, music, drugs, and there are people who go to the extreme of, you know, taking a cobra bite, and then only they feel they're alive. Otherwise, they don't even feel that they are living. So this is how we have to understand. As for the idea that things are not in their place, I understood even when I was a child. So the person asks a question, very interesting question. In this connection, what are the very first things that the supramental force intends to drive out? Or is trying to drive out? So that everything maybe in its place individually and cosmically. So we always want to drive out things, people, everything, because this should not be here, this should not be here. And often the story of Dhuman Bhai, he took a list of people whom he felt they are, you know, just wasting the time in the ashram and the resources. And the mother ticked, this has this quality, this is this quality, this. At the end, everybody is in. So this is the philosophical side of the same experience. So he asks, what will supermind drive out? At one place, mother even goes on to say, when somebody said that so and such people should be driven out of the ashram, she said, driven out? Who should not be kept in the ashram? I believe, I wish that the whole world becomes the ashram, is accepted as part. That's the wideness he carries. So she says, drive out, but will it drive out anything? If we accept Sri Aurobindo's ideas, it will put each thing in its place, that's all. One thing must necessarily cease, and that is the distortion. That is to say, the veil of falsehood upon truth, because that is what is responsible for everything we see here. So what it will remove? It will remove lust, keep the love. Just giving that example. But some people, because of the association, they shun all movements of the heart because they are afraid. So this is where she is reminding. And then there is a little humorous aphorism. The sense of sin was necessary. Nature created this. This moral conscience has nothing to do with the voice of God or voice of the soul. So he... Sri Aurobindo, with his humor, the sense of sin was necessary in order that man might become disgusted with his own imperfections. It was God's corrective for egoism. But man's egoism meets God's device by being very dully alive to its own sins and very keenly alive to the sins of others. Always ready to point fingers here and there. But not able to see inside. And what a beautiful humor Sri Aurobindo says. So if that is the case, then what is it that is needed from the supramental standpoint? That too the mother reveals. That she says that she had an experience of the supramental boat in which she saw certain people are in, certain people are out. And she laughed and laughed after that. She says, 2 hours I was laughing uncontrollably. So she later on reveals why she was laughing. She says, once and for all, it swept away not only all the ordinary notions of morality, but everything that is considered here in India as necessary for the spiritual life. See, the supramental standpoint is so different. From the point of view, it was very instructive. So what are these things which we consider so special? First of all, this kind of so-called ascetic purity. So what is ascetic purity? Reject all the vital movements. Don't wear good clothes, don't go to a shopping place, don't ever buy anything, don't eat outside, cut yourself off from people. This very much appreciated. You see, even that's why sometime back I didn't write fully what I was going to write. There's a picture of old time ashramites. And you see, if you see the picture, actually I know some, read Sri Aurobindo's letters. Outwardly it is very impressive. Why? Because everybody is wearing a dhoti, some are sporting a beard, some are looking, you know, as if, you know. But if you read their letters, which I don't want to name because they are all elders who have gone before us, they would lie, they would not have faith in the mother, and Sri Aurobindo is to remind again and again. And the mother said the coming generations will be better. And why they will be better? Because they are far more straightforward and frank. They don't conceive. One thing good about this generation, very good actually, they call a spade. And they're equally fine if you tell them. They don't actually mind it. The way, you know, we would mind, we would take it to the heart. they may argue their case, their point. But they're ready to argue and ready to discuss. So this idea, she says, what is ascetic purity? Is simply the rejection of all vital movements. Instead of taking up these movements and turning them toward the divine, there used to be one of the sadhak who would close his eyes when he would walk outside. Finally, he left the ashram and went away. Why? Because if he sees a girl or a lady, he may, you know, fall. Now, what a fear you are living in. So this is not the ideal, but because the ashram has started in that context and that way, so the mother started from there. Like if you see those days, all the ladies are in sari with almost not a ghungad, but you know, covered head. But the same mother, when people are ready, she made the girls wear shorts and t-shirts. See, it's a question of evolution from one level to another. So our eyes should be toward the future, what is yet to be done, not what was. Because what was the beginning. A kind of humanity was called, and that naturally understood like that. That you have to be like a sadhu. Sadhu is equal to supramental life. But supramental life is very, very different. So that's what Sri Aurobindo is reminding us. Ascetic purity is simply the rejection of all vital movements. Instead of taking up these movements and turning them toward the divine. That is to say, instead of seeing the supreme presence in them and letting the supreme act freely on them, you tell him, no, that is not your concern. He is not allowed to interfere with them. So this is one thing, and there are other things which we have discussed earlier. So what is important for the supramental action? She says, perfect equality and immobility. Whatever be the situation, whatever be the circumstance, you may be in a marketplace, you may be in the quietude of the room, you may be sitting near the samadhi, you may be in a meeting with people, you may be eating in the dining room, or you may be eating in another place, you have gone out and wherever you are. But the inner being should be in a state of equality. And she says, if there is no equality, in fact, she goes on to say immobility. She says, I cannot transmit the supramental vibration. Even if she wants to give. The other two things she says, are wideness and plasticity. We already have spoken about it. This is the conversation where she says wideness, because you have to take in everything, not supposed to shun anything, but put it in its place. So one is wideness. Second is plasticity. You can't become rigidly attached to one way of life or one thing, but you have to You can't, like some people say for medicine, they become so rigid that we'll never take medicine. And they bring out a quotation from Mother and Sri Aurobindo. Somehow they have this idea that Mother and Sri Aurobindo was against medicine. So I have to sometimes remind ki, okay, I agree you should not keep taking medicine as a way of life. But if they were totally against medicine, they would have never allowed a dispensary to come up. So there are different people needing different things. Like people asked Mother, why do we have water filters? If ultimately it is faith. Because everybody is not ready. There are different stages and we have to understand. And even a person, there may be a moment when he needs the medicines. Because the body is unable to fight it out. So what do? You stand with a rigid idea. So plasticity and wideness and perfect equality. So these are the three things that she reminds us. And then something very interesting. Again, as a reminder, he says, all a series on sense of sin, guilt, all this people carry in their head. I must have done something wrong. Often people ask, even Mother in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. That's why Mother is punishing me. My God, if she punishes, where will you go? People carry this idea. I have seen, even here I have seen. See, Mother gave him, punished. I said, what Mother are you creating? It's a Mother in your head. It's not the divine Mother as she has revealed herself as a Mother of love. If she punishes, frankly, will there be ever any hope? And this after Sri Aurobindo has written so many letters. It may look like a punishment to you, but it is not a punishment. That's why Sri Aurobindo says, even a punishments are a grace and a blessing. Even a rejections are not rejections, but a postponement. So punishment is a human concept. So, Sri Aurobindo writes, examine thyself without pity, then thou wilt be more charitable and pitiful to others. Which means that we keep on pointing others' mistakes, others' errors, but we are oblivious of our own. So, Sri Aurobindo says, I have an increasingly concrete vision of the role that the adverse forces play in the creation. Because people ask, why are they there at all? Is there a purpose? There must be a purpose. And it says of the almost absolute necessity for them so that there can be progress and for the creation to become its origin once again. Their presence was made unavoidable by all these things that were negations of the divine life. So they come to remind us, see, you have not seen here, you see, you have not seen there. But we become their spokesperson when we see the defects of others. Their role is to show us. They are, like Mother said, censors. They are instruments of sincerity. But why they are called adverses? Because they make you feel full of guilt, sin, unfitness, unworthiness. So their purpose is to show us, see, that corner you have not corrected. But we become spokesperson of adverse forces rather than of the Divine Mother's grace. When we tell somebody else, see, there is that defect in you. So that's where we have to understand the line. It was a very intense experience which expressed itself like this. Take all the faults I have committed. Take them all. Accept them. Efface them. So that these forces may disappear. And then she goes further in the same aphorism. Very powerful. Basically, this kind of will for purity. Now here she is talking of purity in that sense. Not purity in to be under the influence of the divine. But purity the way we understand that, oh, I have to be very Mr. Clean. That moral purity and ascetic purity. She says, basically this kind of will for purity. For good, that I am a good human being. in men, which expresses itself in the ordinary mentality as the need to be virtuous, is the great obstacle to true self-giving. Because we wear a mask and we roam around. All the time we want to prove to everybody or show. So among these six cardinal vital defects, one of them that Sri Aurobindo points us is, writes is, all show and sham. You want to project an image because you are conscious that, you know, of an image. So this image projection, and because you are trying to project an image, it becomes the origin of falsehood. Why we are projecting an image? Because we want to show to the world, see, I am good. That's how, why he says some asuras give. But they are giving with this consciousness that I am giving. So that's where Sri Aurobindo reminds us, and the mother, she goes further. This is the origin of falsehood. And even more, the very source of hypocrisy. The refusal to accept, to take upon oneself one's own share of the burden of difficulties. That's why it is so important or courageous to admit a mistake and to understand that I could be wrong. We don't have to proclaim it, because that also becomes, he is so great, he is admitting a mistake publicly. Don't have to do that. But to see, yes, there could be something wrong within me and I need to correct it. That's all. But those who have this constant will for purity and goodness, they project such an image and they start believing in it. And that's how falsehood starts. So what we should do? Something further. Do not try to appear virtuous. If you have virtues, very nice. If you are courageous, it's a virtue. Wonderful. But don't try to appear something which you are not. See how much you are united, one with everything, that is anti-divine. That's how Sri Krishna starts the Gita. He tells Arjun, you are indulging in mithyachar, hypocrisy, falsehood, mithyachar. Why? He says, because this is not true what you are saying. You are saying because you want to be good and virtuous. And that's why you don't want to fight, because people will say, see, this fellow destroyed his own people. Yes, people may say so. But what is more important to be is to be united with the truth of things. And the truth of things, as Sri Krishna reveals on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, is that I am risen to destroy the people. So do not try to appear virtuous. Take your share of the burden. Accept yourselves to be impure and false. And in that way you will be able to take up the shadow and offer it. So see what are our own, each one has their own shadow, and we have to keep offering it. Not be afraid of seeing it, not be disheartened, not feel I am unfit, etc., etc. Everybody has. And insofar as you are capable of taking it and offering it, then things will change. Do not try to be among the pure. Accept to be with those who are in darkness and give it all with total love. Each of these is a meditation, actually. When I used to read them, I would just feel this is something so amazing. Unfortunately, we give those quotes. I have not seen this quote circulate. And then you have to give the full thing. You can't just give a part, because then you see the understanding. And sometimes we miss a crucial word. Do not appear, try to appear virtuous. So each one has one's own defects, and one has to accept it and offer it and come out of it. That's how it is. Then in the same, there's something very interesting which he says, we'll quickly read it and then go further about this virtue. So once she say, okay, we'll read it later, about how she speaks about the physical transformation of the body, how organs will be replaced by chakras, those centers of energy, pulsations. And she says the problem is the moment, she says especially about the heart. The moment you, because you have two hearts now ready. I'm talking of those in whom physical transformation is going on. This is the physical heart. It is circulating thing. There is the other heart which is trying to replace it. But during the moment of replacing, If the machine is running, you never replace on a running machine, isn't it? So if the machine is running and you try to replace, it may collapse because you have to remove one. So that's why mother had said that, you know, if she enters into a cataleptic trance, you let the body remain for some time. Because we do not know what's going on. She had seen all this. That during that process of replacement and adjustment, of course, the very something which she has said will take about 300 years. So we need not read it now. But just to understand that so much they have spoken about and revealed to us. Here she speaks about 300 years. Those who want a reference, page 144, Collected Works of the Mother, volume 10. Sri Aurobindo spoke of replacing the organs by the functioning of the chakras. The disciple is asking this question. Mother says, yes, yes, he said 300 years. Before that, she has said that your inner consciousness has to change. You can't expect physical transformation unless there is a transformation of the consciousness. So the triple transformation, the psychic transformation, the spiritual, the supramental of the consciousness. Then finally the physical, which she says that 300 years, Sri Aurobindo said. Of course she laughs after it, that you know, you don't think it's started in you right now. Something starts, but not the full thing. And then two more things and then we can. She also says something which I have been telling people, but anyways, she speaks about those who have departed. She says she went last night. I spent at least 2 hours in a world which is subtle physical, where the living and the dead intermingle without feeling any difference. It doesn't make any difference. There is no difference. They don't know who is living, who is dead. The living and the dead are meeting with each other. And there, they don't know. They are happy to meet each other. The living were there, those whom we call the living, and those whom we call the dead. They were there together, they are together, they moved together, they played together, and all this was in a pretty light, quiet and very pleasant. It was very pleasant. I'm sure some of us would have had this experience sometime or the other. I said to myself, there, men have made a break like this, and then they say, now dead. And dead. The best part of it is that they treat them as they would treat something unconscious, yet the body is still conscious. So we should be, she speaks about keeping the body, if possible, not if possible. She has said 24 hours you must give, 24 hours to 7 days. Because the consciousness takes long to withdraw from the form. And if we quickly take it, hurriedly take the body, then a lot of work which has been done, especially in those who have participated in conscious yoga. So a lot of work which has been done that gets lost. But, well, even here it's difficult to explain. And it's not difficult. You just need to keep one room dedicated for this purpose. It doesn't require any big arrangement. At least in ashram, I would suggest that it's a very simple thing. You keep, make a room. So many places where you can keep the person and nice music, nice. They do it in Auroville actually. They have this in Auroville. It's so beautiful. Dedicate a room only for this purpose. People have lived their own whole life. At least let them depart nicely. That's the best send off. Rather than 4 days later, 10 days later, which is not necessary at all. But simply to allow the consciousness to withdraw with nice atmosphere, nice music, and somebody can go there, light a lamp. After 24 hours, it's okay. So, this is because we don't, I have only one logic to it, that because we don't read Mother and Sri Aurobindo, and we don't even encourage reading Mother and Sri Aurobindo. That's the sad part. So, what is the way to get out of this tragedy? Because it's all around. You see this, not just a personal tragedy, but a collective. So the mother says, there can be no doubt that if you sincerely want to get out of it, it is not so difficult after all. You have nothing to do. You only have to allow the Lord to do everything. And He does everything. He does everything. It is so wonderful, so wonderful. Mind will not allow. You have to do something. And I've seen, if you wait, just allow the grace to act. But one has to wait, not start doing chatpat and become tense. I've seen people being carried by the grace through seemingly impossible situation. Not that their outer life became great or something, but still, it was something exceptional the way they were carried despite everything, despite all the challenges and difficulties, as if there was a hand which was carrying them sheltered. And it was amazing. If you look at it from that standpoint, you see it something so wonderful. So she says, He takes anything, even what we call a very ordinary intelligence, and He simply teaches you to put this intelligence aside to rest. That's the difficult part. What does He say? Inverted commas. There. Be quiet. Don't stir. Don't bother me. That intelligence, He puts it aside and says, I'm doing my work. You don't allow this too much of mental calculations, analysis, fears, anxieties, worry. And then actually I've seen people mess up things. Because already situation is complicated. And I often use this example that a lady is cooking a nice meal. She knows everything. And something is going on. We don't understand. And we go there and say, no, why don't you do this first? Why don't you put this masala? It will be like, and if she has turned aside, we end up doing it. You will make a mess. So, just allow the mind. Don't stir. Be quiet. There. Be quiet. Don't stir. Don't bother me. I don't need you. She's talking about this mental intelligence. Then a door opens. You don't even feel that you have to open it. It is wide open. You are taken over to the other side. All that is done by someone else, not you. And then the other way becomes impossible. It's such an experience. It's a real thing to be known, seen. At least I have seen it, and I'm sure many of us have seen it. That a situation which seems, this is impossible. Nothing can happen. You have to do this, you have to do that, you have to leave this, you have to leave that. But then you just surrender to her with a beautiful aspiration. All desire, ego should be on the quiet. With a will for harmony, with a will for truth, with a will for light to manifest. And slowly, slowly, it's like her hand is shaping events, circumstances, people, things, situations. And then after some time, you begin to realize, oh, she is doing it. And after some time, when the work is over, you just wonder. One could have never even conceived it can be done this way. She does it. Putting everything just where it should reach. So that's what she's reminding us. All this, this tremendous labor of the mind striving to understand, toiling and giving itself headaches. It is absolutely useless. Absolutely useless. No use at all. It merely increases the confusion. You are faced with a so-called problem. What should you say? What should you do? How should you act? Shivinda even goes on to say, if you keep stressing that, the problem increases. Because you are giving too much attention to it. So what we should do? There is nothing to do. Nothing. You only have to say to the Lord, there, you see, it is like that. That's all. And then you stay very quiet. And then quite spontaneously, without thinking about it, without reflection, without calculation, nothing, without the slightest effort, you do what has to be done. That is to say, the Lord does it. It is no longer you. He does it. He arranges the circumstances. He arranges the people. He puts the words into your mouth or your pen. He does everything, 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 everything. You have nothing more to do but to allow yourself to live blissfully. And so much so that even sometimes when you feel, oh, why did I write? I wish it would have been otherwise. But that is exactly what was required for things to change in a certain way. I mean, it's a marvel actually. Difficult. So many examples where you may feel with your mind, oh, I wish I would, should have done. Always there is that I wish. But then you just leave it. It's done. You had offered it and that's how it happened. Then you see, oh, it's good that I did what, if you look from a mental standpoint, you may say it was a mistake, but it was just the right thing to be done. And it's after effects which you felt that that moment that, oh, this could have been avoided. But you see, that was just what was helpful and what was necessary when you look at the total picture. It's so amazing. So events, circumstances, everything. Because he is beyond good and evil. He is beyond all this. There is no error. That's how this whole thing is based on an aphorism that there is no error. I am more and more convinced that people do not really want it. People don't want this, unfortunately. Once again, she is reminding us, and with that we can stop. Yes, they try to come in again by habits. He says that, what to do, mother? We tried, but it comes back by habits. He says, yes, they try to come in again by habit. You only have to say, Lord, you see, you see, you see. It is like that. Even the most inveterate, recalcitrant parts. You see this fool? This fool. That's how it is. You see this fool? And it is all over immediately. But we want to be very proud, we want to be good, virtuous, all these 100 things. Simply to be sincere, that is to say, to truly want everything to be right. Right here is not about right and wrong, but everything to be the way it should be. You are perfectly conscious that you can do nothing about it, that you have no capacity. Usually this state comes when you have tried and you reach a point where you say, it's beyond me. And then, you know, that intervenes. I feel more and more that this amalgam of matter, like this of cells, all that is pitiful, it is pitiful. When you see how you are made, when you really see how you are made, it is really nothing, nothing. No, you may be full of an excellent goodwill and then you want to do it. That's what complicates everything. Or else you don't have faith, you believe that the Lord will not be able to do it and that you must do it yourself because He does not know. Not only he does not know. After all, I have done the mistake. I have to go through this suffering. It's my karma I am reaping. All these ideas, notions will come. But if we really say, he knows. She knows. She knows everything about everything. After all, whole creation has emerged out of her. Is sustained by her. She has pulled creation out of extreme inconscience, darkness up to this point. Doesn't she know all the forces at play? But she has her own way. Don't say it should happen right now. I have faith. Keep offering and wait. Even if things don't seem to happen outside, they are happening inside. This too I have seen. Something is happening, a growth, a progress, something of everyone. If you keep turning to her. Mother laughs when she says, because we think he does not know. This kind of stupidity is very common. How can he see things? We live in a world of falsehood. How can he see falsehood and see? But he sees the thing as it is, exactly. He sees exactly the measure of falsehood and truth and the mixture. And he has the sieve and the fire and everything to bring out truth out of falsehood. I am not speaking of people of no intelligence. I am speaking of people who are intelligent and who try. There is a kind of conviction like that somewhere, even in people who know that we live in a world of ignorance and falsehood and that there is a Lord who is all truth. They say, precisely because he is all truth, he does not understand. He does not understand our falsehood. I must deal with it myself. I knew a lady, it's a humorous story. She came and she joined the ashram. She has the prosperity to fill the chit. So she while filling, says, you know, my problem is what I want, I can't put it in the chit. So she was asked, why? What is it? She said, I want a boyfriend. Now you can imagine, say, I can't put in the chit. So I said, why don't you put it? You don't put in the chit, you put a chit to mother. See what happens. Because we don't know how she works, what she operates. I'm not saying it's a wonderful thing to, but this is how what is needed for us to go through, either as an experience or this, she provides in her way which is beyond human comprehension. And that's why she says, now I can feel him everywhere. She will take away the wish. The least that will happen is that, you know, if we place it at her feet, then she will take away the wish, the desire, or suddenly we'll know some story and say, okay, thank God, after some time. So she says, I can feel him everywhere, all the time, even a physical contact. He's there, he's everywhere. He is far away only when we think he is far away. So we can stop here and continue. As I said, I don't want to rush through this volume because this volume is amazing, simply amazing. Jai Ma.